Hi, I'm Rachel Sosin, and this is 6 Degrees of Innovation, a podcast that grew out of my natural curiosity and love of innovative solutions to big and little challenges. Each episode, I'll speak with someone who is making an impact in an innovative way. Listen in as we talk about what got them started, what problem they're tackling, and how it's going. This week, I'm talking with Tim Ward, co-founder and CEO of Think Cyber, a company taking an innovative approach to cybersecurity awareness. Instead of the typical boring, sometimes fear-mongering, sometimes overly simple, and sometimes overly complicated security awareness training that we have all come to know and loathe, Think Cyber is the only company utilizing behavioral change theory in the moment to teach employees how to make better decisions. User-centered design, educating and empowering. I didn't know I could get so excited about cybersecurity. Hi, Tim. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Great to be here.
I'm excited to say that you are actually my first episode guest that is a direct link from a previous episode. So thank you for that.
That's cool.
I am really excited that you're here. I think that the work that you do is really fascinating. And so I'm excited to talk about Think Cyber and Red Flag's product in particular. And rather than me trying to explain what it is and waxing entirely too long and ineloquently, I think I would ask if you could explain what Red Flags is and what was the moment that made you realize there was a real gap in the security landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably I should start by thanking Gemma for doing the intro and helping with that 6 degrees of innovation. Myself and my co-founder were head of information security, and my co-founder was head of InfoSec at a large kind of corporate. So we were kind of in this world and we had reasonable budgets. So we were using all the traditional approaches to try and help people avoid cyber threats. And we kind of felt that they didn't work. We knew they didn't work. They weren't having the impact we wanted. And so to explain what Red Flags is, so Red Flags is a software product that is designed to deliver interventions to steer and guide people to make secure decisions. And it does it right in the context where they're working. So it's looking for those risky behaviors. It's seeing they're about to do something risky, and it's trying to steer and guide them and educate them at that point in real time. And I suppose as to how we got here. So we'd seen there was a problem, and we got together and we created Think Cyber on the basis that we wanted to do something about people-centric security. Mm-hmm. But that was quite a wide kind of, and at that time, almost not that specific. So it's been a bit of an evolution in some respects. And we work with academics, in particular, Pam Briggs at Northumbria University, to explore kind of what wasn't working with traditional approaches. And it all started to come together in a way. And one of the things that I find quite interesting about it is that one of the strongest behavioral models that kind of drives what we do is thinking about what BJ Fogg says, the Stanford professor. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit before we started, Rachel, about how you build habits. And we should come to that in a second, because actually his books are a little bit self-help in some respects. But that model has been talked about in the security awareness industry, I think, for quite a long time. But it talks about the idea that you need to be motivated to do something, you need ability, fairly obviously. It also talks about the need for a prompt. And we just couldn't see anything that was delivering a prompt, that nothing was actually nudging or prompting. And so we sort of went down that track of thinking, how do you actually help people? How do you nudge them, prompt them, guide them, intervene and steer? And that starts to get you towards where you're actually being proactive and preventative as well. So you're not just trying to educate people, you're trying to help them and prevent the threats from happening. So that's a fairly long-winded intro to kind of how we got here, but it's still evolving. Like, we're still reading about psychology theories and thinking, okay, well, how do we play that in? How do we, because behavior is really complicated. There's no silver bullet. There's no one answer. So it's kind of quite a layered thing as well.
If behavior change were simple, then there would be all sorts of things in my life that were very different.
Indeed, so. But that's a good point, because I think people come at it a little bit as if it is simple. So certainly in the world of security, the focus is all about the motivation element. Like, right, let's scare everyone. Let's make it a deterrent. You'll get in trouble, or the bad guys will get you. Or in fact, you'll get in trouble because you've clicked on a simulation that we've done and we'll tell you off. And like, well, that has the real risk of actually driving things underground and increasing your risk rather than decreasing it.
That feels like that sort of parenting 101. You know, if kids are afraid they will get in trouble, then they will not tell you the thing that maybe they probably should have.
Absolutely. And that's kind of that psychological safety, which I know Gemma's quite focused on, that idea as your organizational culture, sort of making people feel comfortable to say, help, I don't know what to do here, or I've made a mistake, but I want to correct that mistake.
Particularly in thinking about the nudges and that the real time side of red flag, you know, so I am relatively new in a job. Over the last several months, I've had to do a bunch of different compliance trainings and things like that. And I can say that I passed all of those tests, and I'm not entirely sure that I would necessarily remember the details today. I think I remember the gist. So I guess that puts me, you know, not completely in the red zone, but perhaps in the amber, in terms of, you know, my relative security risk as an individual. I hope none of my employers are listening. but I also feel like I can say that because I think that probably most employers know that.
I think if they're honest with themselves, they should realize that they've ticked a box by giving you that. And it's, you can't dispute that people do need some education and awareness, and it's brought it back up into your mind recently. So you're probably thinking about it a bit more. In 3 months or 6 months, not so certain that you'll be necessarily thinking about security and will there be any change to your behaviors?
Exactly. What does nudging look like? Because I think, honestly, I'm not entirely sure that on any given day I would necessarily know what the moments in my day were that were potential risk moments.
Yeah, there's two approaches that we take. So one is almost playing to that kind of psychological idea of priming. So when Darren Brown's trying to make you say a certain word, then what you don't realize is that he's been blasting that word at you all day prior to it. And so you just say it and you have no control because you've been primed. And so instead of doing your traditional awareness, the simplest thing we do is we just push content to do with cyber onto your desktop, but like in tiny, like 10 second, 30 second, maybe a minute chunks. So, and that's just, it's a bit about priming. It's also a bit about the learning science of spacing, in that you space your education out. You don't, like when you're revising, you can cram, but it's not as effective. Yes, a lot of people do cram, but it is not as effective. If you space your learning out and you come back to things repeatedly, then you retain more and you retain it for longer. So the simplest thing we do is we might just drop an extra piece of security awareness. So rather than you doing this one long course and passing the test, we might drop something on your desktop every couple of weeks. And we'll work hard to make that interesting and relevant. The next level up from that might be, as you open Outlook, we might remind you that phishing's a thing. So again, we're helping you in the context. So obviously that's where phishing threats lie. If we remind you as you open Outlook, even if it's subconsciously, you're going to be a little bit more, oh, okay, is that a phishing email? So that's an effect. And then when you go even further with the nudging, then you're looking for those moments like, right, you've got an email from someone that you have never sent to before. It's got a link in it. We might suggest you be a bit cautious about clicking it. Or maybe if you do click it and you then get to a web page and you start to enter your email address and password, we might nudge you then to say, okay, you just clicked a link in an email from someone you never emailed before, and now you're typing in a username and password. Are you really sure and happy to be doing that? And in some cases, obviously, that's completely fine. But in other cases, it might be, oh, hold on. I clicked this link and I thought I was in my Microsoft. but that URL doesn't work. And so we've kind of given you that nudge to stop and think and that sort of thing. So that's the kind of concept behind it, is maybe kind of disrupting a habit that you've already got and mm-hmm. making you kind of stop and think, or it's subconsciously just queuing you up to be thinking a bit more about security.
That makes a lot of sense. As a kid, I was a notorious crammer,
we all do it. It gets you through.
Exactly. I think it got me through, but you're right. It didn't necessarily really embed the information. And now as an adult, I find that I'm much more of sort of an information grazer. And there are all sorts of things that I know, but I couldn't necessarily tell you where I learned them, but that they actually sort of have embedded themselves into my, you know, little mental library. And I think
it's interesting that, isn't it? Because that sort of, and you reinforce that, like, if you come across something that relates to that, I think that's how, like, so you build connections in your brain because you've got like all that. And so you can try and use that psychology. And so if you hang a piece of security awareness off something that's topical in the news, then you're helping people connect and they go, oh yeah, I've read about that. Or when they go and read about that again, they think about cyber. So you're trying to just, and that's that kind of idea of availability, like, because you're looking for an anchor when you're trying to make a decision. And so if it comes to mind because you've seen it on the news or you've seen something related to it, then again, you're thinking about security. So it's these little tricks. And that's our whole thing, is trying to, let's just, so during the pandemic, someone who I'll talk about a bit later, set me a challenge to post on LinkedIn virtually, every day for 6 weeks. And I went a bit bonkers because I have issues with challenges I get set. So I actually did it pretty much every day for a year, and obviously quite quickly ran out of things to talk about. But then I started to, I was just reading about psychology and behavior stuff. And so every time I read something, I was like, well, how could I map that onto cyber? And so that was a way of kind of, and there's so many new ways. So we're always trying to think of, okay, well, how would you relate that onto this? How could we help people by understanding that concept about people's brains and how they think and what makes them tick?
I really like that. And I like the idea of an anchor for helping people absorb knowledge. And if there is something that they can connect to, that makes a lot of sense to me. Something that you wrote about that really, that struck me was sometimes the people who are developing programs know a lot more than the people who are utilizing programs, particularly when it comes to trainings and things like that. Mm. And so how do you make sure that you're anchoring to the user's sphere of knowledge? Like, you and your colleagues know a lot more, both about security than, you know, me as your target customer does, and also probably a lot more about psychology than me as your target customer does. How do you kind of make sure that you're like mapping to the right place?
Yeah, I think that's been a real problem in the industry. Because obviously when we started doing the idea of security awareness, of trying to training people and telling them about cyber, the people doing it were security practitioners generally. Exactly right. Their mental model of the world is they just get it because that's what they think of. And they found it really hard to write things in ways that other people would get. And I think one of the psychological kind of concepts is called the curse of knowledge, that idea of someone who does know something really well finds it really hard to explain it in a way or to understand that other people won't get it. And it is because your mental model, it just kind of makes sense to you. So I think understanding that's the first step, because it means you can go, right, okay, I need to think about this in layman's term. I need to keep it simple. But then also, I think, going back to the behavioral models and BJ Fogg, one of the things he talks about is make it easy. So, and again, cybersecurity practitioners tend to start to bamboozle people like, here's all the technical things you should spot about phishing. Realistically, experts aren't going to spot some of those and will fall for things. So make it simple. Give people really easy things to do, like if you're not sure, ask, or just make it safe for people to ask for help. So, you talked about the psychology of kind of us understanding psychology. I think for us, as a business, what we're trying to do and help our clients with is say, look, let's just think about what that psychology says and try and use some of those ideas. So things like, we know that people are influenced by others, like social norms, social proof. So let's just find really simple ways of playing that into our content. And so that you can kind of, you can use simple examples of so-and-so has reported something. Have you reported anything? Or like this department or the security team have prevented all of these things. Have you reported anything this month? And that's kind of the idea of reciprocity. So you're trying to, you're just trying to give, we try and in our talks give really simple examples of, so not going too complicated into the psychology, just go like, here's a simple example of using this idea, because we know, because the theory says it's a way to influence people's behaviors and it has impact. So none of them are silver bullets though. So like none of them will solve all the problems. So you're just kind of, you're layering up and trying some of these different techniques, because they might go from, I don't know, 50% of people reading that particular piece of content to 75 or 80%. And that's good. That marginal difference is helpful.
I don't really know how regulations around compliance training works, but I always sort of assumed part of why I would do compliance trainings once a year, once every 6 months or whatever, that include a quiz and a score, was because there was some sort of regulatory requirement that said that. Yeah. Is that, and I imagine that that is also probably very different from country to country to country, or maybe from industry to industry, but, how does that work, and how does using behavior change and nudging techniques work within any kind of regulatory requirements?
Yeah, it's a bit of a challenge actually, because it is industry specific. So you'll have some industries where, yeah, they absolutely have to have mandatory training, or they have to have shown that they've trained everyone. They need 100%, sometimes 95% coverage. There needs to have been a test. And it's almost a bit sad that, because what you're doing is you're driving a box ticking culture. It doesn't matter. There's no test on how the quality of that training. There's no test of how hard that quiz was, really. And now increasingly we are seeing auditors and regulators asked for, and we want to see how you're improving things, how you're changing. Mm-hmm. And that's where behavior comes in. So, okay, how are you improving behavior by doing this awareness? But I mean, we can, obviously, if we're drip feeding content like a minute every couple of weeks, we have completion stats on who's done that, what percentage of people, and we can put questions in it. And in fact, when people send out traditional awareness and send an email, say, Rachel, go and do your awareness training, they tend to get about 15 to 20% people do it. And then the big chasing starts, and all the line managers have to get involved and start telling. And that was one of the reflections that me and Mike had in our corporate. Like, we were involved in managing those spreadsheets of like, who's done it, who hasn't, let's go and chase them again. And companies struggle to get people to do it. And so then they get into this cycle of saying, right, we're going to ding your bonus, or we're going to lock you out of your IT if you don't do it. And well, that's great, but now you've built a negative incentive, and everyone knows that mandatory training is there to cover the business's back, not to cover your. And so you're actually culturally sending the wrong message there if you want people on your side. So back to my point, one of the things we can do with nudging is that we get 80% engagement with our content rather than that 20% straight away, because it comes to the user. It's just there. And so we can then build on that and almost be a bit more forceful. And if you want 100%, you can kind of appear on the screen and insist they do it. And we won't tend to go down that route, because again, that can be a bit too pushy. And you know that people who do stuff under duress and not really engaging. So there's a balance to be taken there. But we can tackle that compliance thing. But it is one of my bugbears, especially, I mean, in particular, if I come across organizations whose insurers insist they do phishing simulations, because I'm not a huge fan of phishing simulations. I think you can get really variable results depending on the bait. So if you're being measured of, oh, I must have a click rate of 5%, well, if you give people an easy test, you'll get a low click rate. So you control that. So you're doing your own homework there. But also this idea that when people fall for something, you've tricked them, you've embarrassed them, and then you punish them with some training. So I'm not a huge fan of phishing simulators, but some insurers are insisting on it. So I'd really like to open up the conversation. So, well, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to get people to act securely. And if you go back to the psychology, training people once a year and ticking that box, there's so much more to it if you want people to act securely. So let's have a proper conversation about it. But yeah, that can be a bit of a challenge, because compliance is compliance. So, I mean, often we do both. So do the compliance-based aspect of it, But then, okay, let's do some nudging as well. Let's do some behavior change. So you've ticked the compliance box, but you're also now trying to focus on behavior.
I had no idea that response rate in sort of the traditional mandated training would be so abysmally low. And that's just bonkers to me because it's wildly inefficient and both in terms of time and, you know, hours worked. I can't imagine the amount of time, you know, when they looked at your salary and the hours that you were spending chasing people, that just doesn't align in any way that anyone who's concerned about the bottom line should think is acceptable.
No, but you can sort of see why it happens, isn't it? Like you're having a busy day and you get an email from HR or security say, please do your mandatory awareness. You're like, right, that's half an hour. Like my diary's full and so then you move on in your inbox, don't you? Unless at that point, and people have tried all different techniques of, okay, right, encourage people to create an appointment with themselves in a week's time to do it or something like that. But the moment that's gone down your inbox, then really you're waiting till the next chaser email comes out and then the next chase. And eventually that kind of percentage goes up, but then you get to the point where managers are having to say, you haven't done it. And people have scorecards at senior management level, say which departments have done it and which haven't. And it becomes this whole cottage industry.
Yeah.
And so then you can see why people go down the negative incentives route, right? Well, it's performance review time and no one's going to get their performance review until they've done their training. But just that kind of creates the wrong culture, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah. Which I think is, I think there's so many things that are happening right now where culture is just sort of, I don't know, having a reckoning or is at a crossroads or whatever the phrase might be. And maybe it's also a little bit generational. You know, I think that the things that, like I'm at the tail end of Generation X, and the things that we just sort of accepted as, well, that's how the workplace works, are things that, you know, the millennials and Gen Z would never tolerate. And I think that's probably a good thing, you know?
And I think there's a kind of, some of the conversations I try and have with people is around talent acquisition or retention. And so, I mean, obviously I get that a big bank is going to manage some security by just simply turning everything off. Like you cannot use USBs, you cannot use your own email, you cannot upload files places. But there's an argument that those blanket rules maybe don't need to be applied everywhere. And there's a balance that if you could uplift the human factor, potentially using nudges, obviously, to help people like manage that risk and get that risk to a certain level, you might be able to stop blocking some of those things. Then you could have potentially happier staff and better retention, and people could access tools that make them creative and things like that. So it's that real kind of balance. And that's come out a bit recently with ChatGPT. So I talked to people and a lot of organizations saying, that's right, we don't worry about that, we blocked it. People probably still type stuff into their phone, but anyway, but they blocked. Whereas what you could do and what we've done is put a nudge on. So when people go to it, you're kind of saying, it's okay to use this, please don't copy any company data here. And so kind of you can change the cultural approach to some of this. And it does depend on the organization, and every organization is different. I mean, I get that, and especially in a bank where they've turned all those things off now, that it's going to be a brave person to say, right, we're going to turn that on again now on my watch, and we're going to use this instead. But I think certainly in other organizations, when they come across these threats, they go, okay, well, what's our culture say? What do our values say? How are we going to approach this? Are we going to be a blanket no, or are we going to support people and try and help them do it securely with all the positives you get from the flexibility and the access to creative tools and things?
I think that makes sense. I think there is a phrase that you used, self-efficacy, and the idea that if I know how to approach a situation, then and I know what to do in the face of, you know, X circumstance, then I'm much more likely to tell my superiors if I need to, if something has happened. I'm also more likely to be able to find a solution or know how to pivot or things like that. And I think that so by teaching and nudging around security, it also, I think, kind of empowers an employee to be able to use those kinds of problem solving or at least awareness pieces in other areas of their work, and vice versa. You know, if you're giving me freedom to develop a new plan of action over here, then I will feel more inclined to do it here. But if in security you've only ever told me, you know, no, then I'm just going to end up finding workarounds.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's some really interesting research around that area of self-efficacy. And so potential motivation theory is this idea that any, when we're faced with a decision under threat, there's two assessments we make. One is of the threat, like what's the risk, what's the impact to me? And the other is the response. Can I cope with this? How much is it going to cost me to do this thing? But I do, or do, and do I know how? And the research has suggested that when you focus purely on the threat, there can be either a fairly weak or maybe a neutral or even a negative impact on people's behaviors. Negative being you actually make it worse. So if you focus on the threat because you scare them, so if you focus too much on threat, but if you focus on the coping and help them with the coping. So you need a little bit of threat. I think people need to know it's important and it matters. But if you focus more on the coping, the research has shown that you can get much more impact. So you can see change. And so I think that's just really interesting because it's a whole shift for the industry but we're all obsessed with having images of hackers in hoodies and stuff and telling people all these dire things and dire consequences, and when actually give people a really easy coping strategy. So that is a message. So you do need to train people. You need to give them those coping strategies, but focus a bit more on them and a bit less on scaring people. And nudges can be part of that, kind of the steering people towards something when they need to think about it. So, okay, I'm not sure what to do here. Well, like if you're trying to upload a file somewhere and it's to a site that perhaps the organization's not hugely keen on, a nudge at that point to say, here's how to use the tool we do want you to use, and here's a link to it. And you're just kind of making that behavior as easy as possible and giving people a coping strategy that doesn't necessarily interrupt their flow too much, steering them and guiding them. So yeah, that's a really interesting area of research.
When it comes to actually putting red flags in the field, have you come across things that sort of like didn't align with what you expected? Like behavior change is very complicated and sometimes kind of sounds much more simple than it is.
It is perhaps a bit more of an art than a science. I mean, you're using science, but it's so complicated. There's so many different factors. So one of the really interesting things we did initially, so I talked about this idea of dropping content that makes it really easy for people to engage with. And we deliberately do that in quite a passive way. So it appears in the background on your desktop. So it doesn't like force you to look at it. But we did have on it a not now button. The idea being we could allow people to make it go away and it'll come back in a little while and it would keep pestering them, but it would. And what did we do? We trained everyone to click not now, really very effectively. And so we very quickly took that button away because actually it's passive anyway. It's in the background. It's not stopping people doing their work. And now we get much, much higher engagement. So that was a really, really interesting one. And then the other one is that context really, really matters. So we ran a trial and we saw some great behavior change. The thing we wanted dropped. And then in the next month, it rocketed. And fortunately, the trial continued for the following months, where it then went back down again below the initial level again. And of course, we'd done something across account or sort of year end, where just in some organizations at year end, all hell breaks loose, doesn't it? Like everyone's running around. So some of the really good behaviors we'd encouraged, just there was so much more behavior and things going on that. And if we hadn't had that extra month, we basically would have said to the client, we've done our trial and we've effectively made everything worse. But fortunately, we continued. And so that's really interesting that you do need to think quite carefully about context and try. And there's more to it. There's more to most behaviors. It was all quite nuanced. And so when you see a behavior and say, okay, well, that's happening a lot there. For us, what we're trying to do is support practitioners to say, don't use this to say, right, someone so-and-so is being naughty or that person's particularly risky. Use it to understand and then go, right, why? And it's very often a business process that needs changing. It's very often kind of you've got a department whose job is to do X, Y, Z, and the only tools they've got are ones that you don't really want to use. So mm-hmm. you need to think about giving them some tools. And so you're using this to learn about behavior as much as you are to change it, change the behavior. So get that insight as to what's happening and then think, right, okay, if you don't tackle this with a view to, well, what do I want them to do? Like, what's the behavior I actually want? And you haven't got a good thing that they can do. So passwords is a great example. If you haven't got like a password tool to help people store them, then what are you expecting people to do to try and remember all these millions of passwords? Like, how do you do that? You can't. They've got to use the same one everywhere because our brains don't, or they're constantly clicking, I forgot my password. Mm-hmm. So give people the tools as well.
In the 90s, my mother, you know, in the 90s, it was still sort of the day of the four-letter passwords.
Yeah.
And I was going through my mom's office things and came across her diary. And on the back page, so first off, her passwords were written down. and she must have had to change it every 30 days or every 60 days or something like that, because there were a ton. But because it had to be four letters, at a certain point, they just became all curse words. And I thought that was absolutely hilarious. Yeah. But also, now that you have to have, you know, more letters and more characters and things like that, you know, her system wouldn't work unless she combined a lot of curse words, which I guess one could do. Every once in a while, I'll think about that piece of paper, and it's just really funny because it was just a string of them. I think about passwords a lot because sometimes I am really good about using my LastPass and password generation and things like that. And sometimes I really kind of fall on the lazy side. And which I guess sort of connects to what you were just talking about, you know, seeing a behavior change and then seeing a spike and then seeing things level back out. Which made me think about how difficult habit formation can be. So you can teach a new behavior, but if year end is the time when I say, you know, like, it's okay, all my bad habits can go out the window, all my good habits can go out the window because I just have to get through this year end cycle, then I can see how that it becomes sort of like the behavior change has to take into account those ebbs and flows. And how do you plan for that? Or how do you then sort of do the familiarization, or it's, you know, sort of like between Thanksgiving and Christmas, all diets go out the window. And then January 1st, everyone starts, you know, only eating spinach. So like,
trying to build or strengthen the habits in the first place. So kind of one of the talks I do, I talk about someone doing their awareness training, and then they go on holiday, and then they come back to work and they're really busy, and then they've been out the night before, and then they get asked to do something risky. And you're like, 6 months has passed. What hope do they have of remembering stuff? And so so that is where, like you say, the context has kind of mean that, and it's a pressured situation because a client has asked this person to upload a file. And so you're going to do it, aren't you? And so the idea, I suppose, of what we're arguing is, if you had been drip feeding stuff little and often, or if you even delivered a nudge at the point they were trying to do that, then you're increasing that person's chances of remembering what to do, remembering it's important, and so you're trying to kind of just strengthen their ability rather than rely on them remembering it. But you are right. I mean, if organizational processes, so we did some work with looking at some sort of government stuff, and if you've got a department who is just massively delivery focused, then, and that is the message that top management are giving, that it's delivery at all costs, then you will get delivery at all costs and security will go out the window. So that's where it comes really important that the culture of the organization is saying, delivery really matters, but that's secure delivery. We can have both. And so aligning kind of the security message with the organizational mission to say, well, look, there's no point. And that's an interesting one for the NHS. Kind of, if you want to look after patients, with everyone in the NHS does, that security is part of that. Mm-hmm. Because if the systems break or if you lose patient data, well, that's not looking after the patient. So security is part of it. It's possibly slightly lower down the list than the medical stuff, but it is part of it. So it's kind of linking things to the culture of the organization, mm-hmm. the mission of the organization can be a way of helping people go about their business even when it gets tough, but still act securely. And then obviously we think that doing some nudges in and around that also helps at that yeah. point of risk.
Something that you were saying way earlier in this conversation, but that just sort of tripped for me, was using nudges around kind of social community, I guess. And so, you know, Sally in accounts was able to flag this phishing. What has your department done? And that sounds really interesting to me because many moons ago, I worked in politics where one of the big behavior change pieces that we would use would be, you know, at least in the United States, you know, whether or not you have voted in an election is public record, not who you voted for, but whether you voted. So there was always a lot of voter engagement messaging around, you know, compared to your neighbors, you're underperforming. So make sure you vote, which is... Yeah. It is community, but it's also shaming. And so I liked how what you were describing is community, but in a positive sense. And, but it also made me wonder, have you gotten pushback? Do people feel like they're being sort of big brothered or, how do you kind of strike that balance?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, I mean, the social proof is really good. And we talk about, I mean, so Cialdini is the king of kind of influence and persuasion, his books and some of that social norm stuff can be really effective. And it is more effective, the sort of more specific and the closer to people it is. I think his example is the hotel room, isn't it? So people who stay in this hotel room reuse their towel. So people who stay in this hotel reuse their towels. And then even more effective was people stayed in this hotel room. But I think you probably also have to be careful. So you're probably not naming Sally in accounts. And as someone pointed out to me, kind of you need to be careful, like, what's the reputation of the department that you're using this social proof on? Because everyone hates everyone in that department, which you may not know, then you've just used the wrong social proof. So you have to probably have to be a little bit careful there. But the idea is generally, and also there's some good examples of social proof going wrong. I'm not helping myself, but you just have to be careful. I think it was in America again. It was somewhere where people were running off with bits of ancient fossilized wood or something from one of the big national parks or something, and they did a sign that basically sort of said, other people are stealing this, don't be one of them. And what that did was normalize the stealing. So people were like, oh, I hadn't even crossed my mind I could get away with stealing that. I'm gonna steal it too. And so you have to think a little bit carefully and always monitor the impact of what you're doing, like which ways it made the behavior go. Oops, stop, it's not working. In terms of the big brother question, yeah, I mean, I think we do think quite carefully about that. So we can anonymize a lot of what we're doing, so we don't know who's doing it, but we can still see the behavior and try and help you. And the focus very much, and it's a bit about how people land the use of red flags, our focus is all about helping, supporting, guiding, helping you not get in trouble, helping you not fall for something. It's not meant to be spotting people who are misbehaving and so that they can be told off. In fact, that's the old way with the phishing simulations. That's not what we're all about. And so we don't really capture much data, or any data really, about what the behavior is in detail. We just can see, okay, that was an email from someone you don't know and you're about to click the link, let's give you a nudge, and we log that we nudged you. So we can see, and that means we can see, well, how often now are people clicking on those links and have we changed behavior? So there's a bit of a cultural kind of, look, this is here to help. It's not really collating any data about you. It's more about guiding and looking at that macro level of how often do these things happen? Are we seeing an organizational improvement? And I mean, the world of security is quite funny though, because there's a lot, if you do get that reaction, it sometimes makes us laugh a bit, because very likely a lot of other tools already installed in the organization that are doing a lot more logging and knowing a lot more about staff than anything that we do, because everything goes in and out through firewalls and proxies and stuff and all of it, and then web logs and things like that. So there's a lot more information about what you're up to in your organization than you probably like to think. The other side to that is that, and probably no one's got time to look at it. So you're probably fine. But yeah, that's an interesting one.
I remember a sort of a similar conversation with someone in the, I guess it was in the early 2000s. I think something had come out in the United States that essentially the NSA, was the National Security Agency, was listening to phone conversations that they weren't supposed to be listening to, I think is sort of where it started. Yeah. Or like a law had been passed that essentially gave them permission to listen to anyone. It was shortly after 9/11. And I remember having a conversation with someone who worked in defense contracting. And he said, yeah, but don't worry. Like, even if they, you know, magically flipped a switch that turned on listening to every phone line in the United States, there's no personal capacity to actually listen to those conversations. You know, and I thought that was a really interesting point. So looking to today and employers, they may collect the data, but they're only looking at the data that they feel is relevant to look at, I guess. Yeah. So I think that makes me feel slightly better about the my utter lack of privacy is that, yeah, but I'm also not that interesting. So, yeah. And
it's a good defense.
Yeah. I think I'm probably, if they were actually paying much attention to me, I'd probably know that there was a reason. Like, I would know that something was up that had people paying attention. So I guess that makes me feel a little better. The priming and spacing, I think I'm going to be thinking a lot about in terms of learning in general, the sort of learning, but also behavior change and how I can use that for myself. Like, as I said, if behavior change were easy, I'd have a very different life. So thinking about sort of how I can use priming and spacing to make some changes that I'd like to see personally.
I think the BJ Fogg stuff is the really interesting there, and his tiny habit stuff. It's a walking advert for his books, really, but because he talks about the order in which you try and tackle the elements of motivation, ability, and the prompt, the timeliness, and that most people get it wrong, and they start with motivation. And as you say, like if us wanting to be something was all that mattered, we'd all be incredibly fit. We'd all eat really healthily because we all kind of want to, but there were loads of competing motivations. So motivation is the hardest lever of change, he says. Mm-hmm. And so don't start with it, which is why, again, we come to the, like, if you start with the prompt, if you could just prompt yourself. So I don't know. And the fitness one is, I don't know, there's your trainers and your fitness gear are next to the bed and they're there ready for you to put on. And the first thing you do is you put them on. Now you might not make it for the run that day, but you've made it a hell of a lot easier because you've given yourself the prompt. And then you're thinking about ease, and then finally worry about the motivation and give yourself some motivation. So if you think about it in that order, you can get much more effective behavior change. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's really fascinating as a model to use for ourselves in our day-to-day lives, as well as using in cybersecurity.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it makes a lot of sense because there are plenty of things that we do every day because we know that we have to, but are not necessarily anything we're motivated to do. You know, I do the dishes, not because I am excited to do the dishes, but because I know that it is a thing that I have to take care of. So it's funny that then when it comes to building any kind of new habit, we look for a motivation when we haven't, you know, we know that we don't have that in other pieces. Although I should say that I do most of the cooking and my partner does most of the dishwashing. So maybe that wasn't the best example. Yeah. Thank you. This was really lovely. And so I'd like to ask you my final question, which is the question that I ask everybody and is the namesake of the podcast. So I would love to know if you could tell me a person or an organization that is doing something really exciting and innovative that that you're really looking forward to keeping an eye on and seeing where they go.
Yeah. So so the person I chosen for that is called Phil Guest, and he runs an organization called RevCelerate. And he's an ex-Royal Marine and now sort of startup sales guru, I suppose you'd call him. And I think so he's done a lot of thinking and exploration of kind of why do startups struggle to get product market fit and has got some really interesting thoughts on that. And he helps startups kind of go with that kind of go to market learning curve and helps kind of accelerate that. Like, how are you going to go to market? How are you going to build a sales team? And one of the big differences in his approach is that he's perhaps more of a practitioner than a consultant. So he actually gets in and gets his hands dirty and shows you how to do it rather than, because a lot of times, I mean, you do work with startups and I've been on lots of startup accelerators and stuff. You get people telling you how to do things. You're like, well, I can read that in a book. Like, sit down and do it with me. And that's one of the things that I think Phil is really great at. So I'm really, and I know he's trying to, I mean, his organization is already great, but he's looking at ways to productize aspects of that and evolve that. So I'm really interested in seeing where that goes.
You're so right. There's a phrase about consultants, something about, give me your watch and I can tell you what time it is.
Yes.
I just heard that recently. I'm glad to know that he's taking a different approach, and that's really exciting. I'll have to check him out. I think that often people become founders not necessarily because they are interested in business, but because they have a really fantastic idea that they know can have a really big impact, and then the sort of the mechanics of running a business are the thing that they have to learn instead of the thing that they're excited about. So having someone who can really, teach by doing and in a more active way, I think would be hugely beneficial. So that's really cool. I like that a lot.
Excellent.
Thank you, Tim. This has been really great. And I hope that one day I can experience Red Flag directly. I think that it would probably have a much deeper impact on me than the experiences I have had throughout my career that follow much more of the old model. And I love the idea of empowering people to be able to do things better on their own. So I'm really excited to see how Think Cyber goes and what's next for Red Flag.
Excellent. Thank you, Rachel. I've really enjoyed it. It felt like we could have probably nattered on for quite a long time today. So thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining me for this conversation. From security to habits to workplace culture, I've got a lot to think about. Special thanks to Tim Ward, my guest today, especially for being gracious enough not to correct me every time I called your product Red Flag instead of Red Flags. If you are interested in exploring how Think Cyber's Red Flags could help your business, find Tim on LinkedIn or check out thinkcyber.co.uk. Also, thank you to you for listening. Please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and maybe one day I'll be the next Sarah Koenig. If you know someone who would be a great guest, or if you'd like to be on the show yourself, please email me at rachel@sixdegreesstrategy.co or send me a message on LinkedIn. This episode was recorded and edited by me, and the podcast theme music is Strangers in the Night by Vocalista, downloaded from Upbeat.io.